And I think the women that we have speaking today are really a testament to that fact. So with that, first up this morning, we're going to have Jessica Yee. Jessica Yee is a self-described indigenous hip-hop feminist reproductive justice freedom fighter. Yeah. Big round of applause for Jessica. She is 23 years old and two-spirited from the Mohawk Nation. Jessica is the founder and executive director of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, a Can-America-wide organization working on issues of healthy sexuality, reproductive justice, cultural competency, and youth empowerment. She is currently serving as the first inaugural chair of the National Aboriginal Youth Council at the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network and the International Indigenous HIV/AIDS Working Group. And she is also the first North American youth representative at MenEngage International Alliance for Gender Equality. She is a strong believer in the power of the youth voice, and you can see her activisting it up on sites like CNN syndicated Racialicious, Indian Country, Indian Country Today, or pick up her recently released book, Sex, Ed, and Youth, Colonization, Communities of Color, and Sexuality. She is the 2009 recipient of the YWCA Young Women of Distinction Award, a 2009 role model for the National Aboriginal Health Organization, and was recently named one of 20 International Women's Health Heroes by Our Bodies, Our Blog. So thank you, Jessica. Mm-hmm.
Sago, good morning. How's everybody doing? Great. Is anybody feeling good about reproductive justice? Well, I'm going to ask you guys to actually do an exercise for me to stand up to feel good about reproductive justice, because it is 9:30 in the morning and some people were out late last night, not naming names. We've been sitting here for a bit, and I'm used to working with young people, and young people like to scream and shout, so
I'm going to get off the mic.
So you're going to do what I do, and then you're going to do it. Is that easy enough? So if you can't do it for whatever reason, that's fine, but it would be great if you could try. So you're going to do what I'm going to do it, then you're going to do it, okay?
I feel so good! Yes, I feel so good! Ah!
So we're going to do it together on the count of three, okay? And then we're going to do it sexy. One, two, three.
I feel so good! Yes, I feel so good! Ah!
Amazing. Now we're going to do sexy, okay? Now we're going to say, who's feeling hot about reproductive justice? Anybody feeling hot about reproductive justice? I am. I know Simon is. Right? He's getting killed by the fumes of the projector, so you're feeling hot. All right.
I feel so hot! Yes, I feel so hot! Ah!
Okay? Ready? On the count of three. One, two, three.
I feel so hot! Yes, I feel so hot! Ah!
All right, thank you. Have a seat.
So if that was an indication of how this presentation is going to go, you are correct. So Sego, Ayungyats Jessica Ongwehonganigihaga. My name is Jessica Yee. I am Mohawk from the Agwesasne First Nation, Wolf Clan. And if you're wanting to check out what Wolf Clan is, you can come and check out all of my activist stickers on the computer that Simon's on. It's got a little description about Wolf Clan and how loud and abrasive we are. I'm sure that some of you have heard of Mohawks if you ever watched the news and heard about how we shut down people's highways. So needless to say, if I get really pissed off by something, I might just shut down a Halifax highway. If there's any like anti-choicers in the room, then maybe we'll try and shut down their highway. Just kidding. So I'm really excited and thrilled to be here. I want to acknowledge the traditional territory that we are on. Catherine Martin was supposed to be our elder for this morning, but she's not here, so we're hoping that she's okay. And for those of you who don't know who Catherine Martin is, she's a traditional Mi'kmaq woman, and her bio is in your program. She's a really phenomenal activist and also self-described Indigenous feminist reproductive justice freedom fighter. So she's not here, but I do want to acknowledge not only the elders in the room, but those women and those men and those people who have paved the way for young reproductive justice activists like me to be here today. And that woman and women and one of the big matriarchs of reproductive justice is Miss Loretta Ross, who is at the back of the room. And I just want to acknowledge her. Because without Loretta's direction and movement and other sister women like her who she has worked with in my community, people like Alice Genador and Goji Cook, I wouldn't be here today and I wouldn't be able to do the work that I'm doing. And it is because of those women who have paved the way for us to exist. And so I'm really honored to be here with Loretta. And I'm also honored to be here with Joyce of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. And it's really funny because I think it's funny that the three of us are speaking for me because I feel like I'm like the menage a trois between the two. Not to say that that's going to happen, but or maybe it will. But we are a member at the Native Youth Sexual Health Network of Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Justice Organization. Right, Loretta? Not reproductive health anymore.
Yes.
Reproductive Justice, that was adopted at our national membership meeting, and we're also a member of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, so it's funny, because I feel like if there were to be a menage a trois, maybe I could help, you know, start some of the foreplay that's happening there. Maybe that'll happen tonight, so if you weren't thinking of coming tonight, there might be a menage a trois tonight, so you better come on down. Lots of wine plus menage a trois. Amazing. So I also want to thank the conference organizers hugely, particularly Miss Jane, where are you? Because I think that when young people get together, really awesome things can happen. And I think that she has hugely shown that, along with her incredible, loving partner, Simon, here. And I think it's really cool when we see young people get together, especially when their partners are supportive of them, because that isn't always the case for a lot of us. And so it's really cool when we see healthy relationship dynamics when people support each other in their relationships, aren't ready to kill each other, although I didn't see that yet. that might happen also tonight, just kidding. But I think it's really, really awesome. And a lot of people wonder, why as Indigenous people do we spend all this time in the beginning like thanking everybody and acknowledging everybody? And it's kind of because we're not really a self-centered culture. So it's really important for me to do those things to start us off in a good way. So I'm going to ask Simon to please advance the next slide. So I am going to be talking about what Indigenous feminist reproductive justice freedom fighting means to me. And I am speaking the English language, and English is the language of the colonizer. And so a lot of the things I'm going to say and a lot of the translations I'm going to do aren't going to do me or the things I'm going to express justice. And I hope that makes sense to some people, because English can be a really messed up, confusing language. It's a very binary language that in which you have to pick sides for a lot of things. And so I want to acknowledge that I'm going to say a lot of words, and I'm going to do my best to do the things that I know my ancestors have been doing for a long time. And this is actually one of them. And this is one of my absolute favorite pictures in the world. This is from Osoyoos. And for those of you who are familiar with British Columbia, it's the only desert in Canada. And I want to ask everybody, because this will be an interactive presentation, because that's how I do, what is the gender that you see when you look at the picture? Obviously, it's a trick question, because why would I ask you that, right? But somebody can be brave and just shout out, when you look at this picture, whether stereotypically or not stereotypically, what is it that you see? What gender do you see? So people are saying male. Why, from what you know, why do you see male?
Because every time I see somebody with a headdress like that, they're always presented as male.
So every time she sees somebody with a headdress on like that, it looks like they're male. Okay, thank you. Anything else that would denote male?
Might not be wearing a shirt.
Might not be wearing a shirt? And only men don't wear shirts. Anything else? What about the sort of like the strong image that it presents, right? It's kind of like, from what we know, a very male-dominated picture. And now I know a lot of people are like, I don't really want to say it now because she's obviously asking a trick question and I don't want to offend her. But obviously everybody's wrong. It isn't just male. This is, in English, what we would call a transgendered or two-spirited and two-spirited person. And if you look really closely at the picture, which you can't see so well in this light, there are breasts in the picture. Maybe they're not as big as mine, but they are there. And there's a breastplate that's covering them. And the symbol that you actually see on the horse's tail, the two feathers, indicates two-spirited. And so the Osoyoos people, this image that is in Osoyoos is like thousands of years old. And they erected it again 5 years ago to reclaim the notion of healthy sexuality and what it means to have either two spirits, to be more than one gender, to intersect more than one sex. And I like to start off with this image because very often when we get talking, not just about reproductive justice, and I'm going to say RJ for this presentation, not only when we talk about RJ, but every time we talk about Indigenous people, Aboriginal people, Native people, it doesn't sound so nice. It's always really tragic. It's always really sad. It's always really depressing. I think the only recent good news that is really messed up in the media is the Olympic torches did go through our communities. And so there they got to show us kind of a positive light in our communities, but it's from a very messed up perspective. And so it's important for me to start off this way and to show you this image because these are the roots that I belong to as an Indigenous woman. And I think it's incredibly important that we remember a time when these types of theories, notions, frameworks were normal. And not just normal, they were integrated, respected, and held up as powerful in our communities. And I'm extremely proud to be coming from a society where that was. And there's only so many times in today's modern clinical sexual health world where I can raise my hand and keep saying, that's not a new concept, that's an Indigenous concept, and you just don't know. Or we need to relearn what we've lost. Because obviously sexuality and reproductive health are powerful enough things that it causes a whole bunch of controversy. And it is one of the things that was used to take away and colonize a strong Indigenous culture that had strong and healthy sexuality to begin with. So I do like to show that picture so that we, when I'm talking about the following things that aren't so nice in the reproductive justice world for Indigenous people, that you remember that that's where we started. Next slide, please, Simon. And so to that end, I can kind of sum up what I mean by the roots of strong, healthy sexuality and reproductive justice as a very old framework by quoting one of my mentors from my community and who helped shape the RJ movement, Gudgy Cook. And so she says, without taking control of our own lives, starting with our own bodies, we would simply be wards of the state. And what that means is, we may not have had words for sexual or reproductive health or justice or rights. And in many of our languages, we don't even have words for he or she. It's just people. It's just community. It's just nations. And so we might not have words for those, but we sure have as hell believed in our rights over our own bodies since the beginning of time. We did not wait for Christopher Columbus to come teach us about sex. And anybody who thinks that Christopher Columbus came sailing over with like a sex ed book and then magically we had knowledge and rights that's not what happened. So it would have made sense coming from an Indigenous nation or culture that those types of knowledge and awareness would have been inherent in people's communities. So, and just to give you a very plain example, you couldn't have been kind of sure if you were pregnant back in the day. You could have been like, I'm not sure, maybe. And it's the same thing with people have that saying, Indian time. Has anybody ever heard that? People are late, they're on Indian time, or some other ethnicity's time. Catherine's here now. Hi, Catherine. I know Indian time. Indian time. I know Indian time. And Indian time, though, as I had an elder explain it to me, would have been on time because you couldn't have been like, I'm sleeping in, I'm not going hunting this morning, you know, I'll do it later. Like, the sustainability and the viability of your community depended on your actions. And so to that effect, it would have made sense that we would have known our bodies, what to do with them, how they interacted, how to have pregnancy, how to prevent it, what it meant. And that isn't to romanticize Indigenous history or culture at all. It is to understand that those are fundamental teachings and fundamental knowledge that existed within all of our communities. And I'm going to go through a little bit of how that started in a few different nations, namely my own, and how that changed over time and what that means for us today. Next slide, please. So I come from the Mohawk Nation, and most people, if you ever took Canadian history, whether that was a positive or negative experience for you, would have heard of the Iroquois people, right? Has everybody heard of the Iroquois? The Iroquois and the Algonquin fought, blah, blah, blah. In actual fact, Iroquois is a French word, and so they couldn't pronounce our nations, the Haudenosaunee, so they came up with this word called Iroquois. So now you can correct somebody if they say Iroquois. It's not Iroquois, it's Haudenosaunee. And that denotes five nations. And those five nations are actually represented on this flag right here. And the flag that you see is called the Hiawatha Belt. And in the middle of the Hiawatha Belt, we have a tree. Now, what's obviously the most important part of a tree? The roots. And so if you notice how the roots kind of come up and they connect each of the squares, because each of the squares and the tree represent one of the nations. The roots, does anybody want to guess what those actually symbolize in our communities? Women. Women are the roots of our communities. Women tie everything together, are the foundation of everything, are holding all of the nations up. Which obviously means that if women fall in our communities, what happens to everybody else? If women are holding it all up, everything falls apart. And that's kind of what's happened, and that is what's happening today, is our women not being in respected positions of power and authority that other people recognize is affecting the rest of the nations. Is affecting the fact that 90% of our communities are being led by men here in Canada and worldwide. And so it's a sort of mirror effect of what one of our old stories is that if women fall, it will affect the rest of the nation. And that's where we come from. And one of your handouts that you have on your tables actually talks about what I'm talking about. So there are two columns there. One says Haudenosaunee, and the other one says Euro-American, and it actually gives you what I just said, an analysis of what I just said. So comparing where we started to what happens right now, or what is going on right now. And so if you take a look at that, it's a really interesting mirrored effect, left and right, of what's happened and what's going on today. Next slide, please, Simon. So, pulling all of that knowledge together, that's where I come from. And I'm 24 years old, actually. I just had my birthday on January 20th. And knowing all of those things and learning all of those things as a young person, it really upset me that knowing this great history that we have as an Aboriginal woman, we have like no representation in Canada and minimally in the United States on the sexual and reproductive health national scale. And so we have really amazing organizations like Planned Parenthood, etc. However, if we know that as Indigenous people we started the concept of sex education, and today are most highly statistically represented in every negative sexual health outcome there is, why is there no Aboriginal organization or initiative or collective outside of disease control? And that's something that really stayed with me over the years, because I always felt really fundamentally, as a young woman coming from a matriarchal society, that this was knowledge that I had to pass on and share. And knowing that for so many of my peers, sex and reproduction comprised about 90% of the drama that was going on in their life or their community, that there was nothing for them if they didn't want to look at it through a soul disease control lens. And so when I was 20 years old, I got really fed up with all of those things. I went on a trip to British Columbia, and many people, and Joyce knows this coming from BC, Aboriginal culture in BC is a lot more out there, in my perspective. It's a lot more prolific, and I come from Ontario, where I feel like we're a lot more divided, and there aren't as many things that are out there, and that's how I felt when I was 20. And so when I was 20, I went to BC, and I met this elder, and she said to me, she said, Jessica, how come you didn't tell me your nation right away? Why aren't you telling me where you're from? And I was 20, and I was like, because I'm just a person. And she said, if you don't start being proud of your culture and knowing your culture, who's going to carry it on? Whose responsibility do you think that is? And I was like, good point. And so coming from a family and a background, and I always joke about this, I never had a choice to be pro-choice in my life. My mom made us be pro-choice. That was the only option, which was, it's a great option. But I didn't even know that there was like homophobia in the world until I went to school, and I was just like, those kids are dumb. But coming from this perspective and this root, I came back to those communities that I was part of in many mainstream feminist circles, and now that I had this added lens of knowing my culture and being proud of my culture, I felt very separated from it. And I felt like if I wanted to talk about more than just access and rights to sexual and reproductive health, if I wanted to intersect it or have an intersectionality with something else, that was not allowed. And I remember 3 years ago talking about reproductive justice after coming, I went to BC and then I went to the United States, looking at the work that had been happening with RJ in the United States and coming back to Canada and people saying, what are you talking about? We don't need that. Abortion is legal in Canada. There's lots of access. What are you talking about? And that was a really big blow for me, because I came with all of this emotion and all this inspiration from both an elder, both from the momentum that was happening in the States, to have people in Canada say, there's no racism here. There's no other extra issues. You're just making something out of nothing. And as many of us know, as Canada is a great quote-unquote nation, we have a whole bunch of invisibilized stuff that's going on. And as somebody now who works both in the United States and in Canada nationally, people often say to me, well, Canada is so much better than the United States, and you guys don't have to worry about things. You have universal health care, you have gay marriage, you have legal access to abortion. What are you guys complaining about? And my response to that is, you just can't see it. It's just not as visible on a more outside lens. And as many of us know who work intensely in communities, that is so far from the truth of what is happening in Canada, what is happening outside of mainstream urban centers like Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal, which are the minority in Canada. If you look, relatively speaking, from big cities to rural centers, there is so many more issues that are going on in this country that we do need not only an RJ framework, but we need to believe that RJ is going to work in Canada on some level, and that it's not this US inflection that we have to deal with. That maybe it was something that was here a long time ago that we need to bring back. And so taking all of those experiences, that's actually how I started this organization when I was 20. I started it with my sister and my best friend in my basement. I think I bribed them with like pizza and beer or something. And I, because you need three people to incorporate an organization, and I was like, "Can you sign this paper, please?" And they had no interest in sexual or reproductive health, and they were like, "Whatever, free pizza and beer. I'll sign my name." And that it was really, really grassroots like that. And people like Jessica Shaw, who was over there, I'm sure you remember when I was first starting out, and it was like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I really want to do this, and I really want to do that, and that was literally 3 years ago. And so now we've been extremely blessed and honored to be taken seriously, and now to be both a national network across Canada and a network across the United States. And Simon, if you could hit enter. What that also means for us, besides our regular programming and projects that we do have, it also means that we're doing quite a bit of research in the areas of cultural retention. And what I mean by that is all those things that I'm describing to you guys about the knowledge that existed in our communities prior to colonization, after colonization, throughout the years, is knowledge that we're trying to sustain in our community right now. And we're really trying to empower young people to be health researchers in these areas to get that knowledge back and to sustain it in communities. And that's something that is really, really integral for us if we want to exist as a network beyond the 3-year survival years that we've gone through right now. If you could hit enter again, please, Simon. Okay, so where do we want to begin with translating some of this knowledge that I'm talking about? How many people here have heard in some shape or form, whether it's from your culture or from an Aboriginal culture that you know, that women are life givers? How many people have heard that before? Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question. How many people here are their friend's personal counselor without getting paid for it? Okay. How many people here work and have taken care of children at the same time? Okay. How many people here let your friend crash at your house when they're drunk or high or otherwise not coherent? Excellent. Do you think that those are all forms of life giving? Yes? No? Maybe so? Yes. So for the majority, some of us are saying yes. So this whole thing about life, like life beginning with women, women are life givers, I think needs to be expanded. Because do you only become sacred once you push out a kid? Like if you were to take that literally, it's translated in English, if you were to take that literally, that's what that means, right? Women are sacred because they produce life, physically produce life. We all just named the different ways that we produce life other than physically producing life. And I think that that's where things get lost in translation. There is a teaching in my own community about women are life givers. But in my language, life giving is on a circle. It's on a huge spectrum of the different ways that we give life. And so if you hit enter again, Simon. For us, that also means the recognition, besides the fact that women physically can produce babies, that our bodies are powerful and what that really means. And this is a friend of mine. This is Jenny Williams. She's from Nain Nunatsiavut, which is in Northern Labrador. And I thought I would put her on these slides because she's from the East Coast. And this little girl that you see here in the pictures isn't her daughter. That's her sister. And in many of our cultures, it is practice to not just take your own family in, but to get that sacred status if you take care of others in whatever capacity that means. And so I think it's so fundamentally important that we not take things just at face value, but that we re-look at, if you're trying to get a buy-in in any other community to talk about RJ or to talk about the intersectionalities of sexual and reproductive health, that you don't let English or the Western theories of reproduction limit you or get you tangled up in this whole, ooh, life-giving, what does life really mean, those types of things. And where does that also apply and sit with men? And young men, particularly, who are growing up in these very patriarchal societies that we still have. Next slide, please, Simon. So there's a whole bunch of things that we started as Aboriginal or Indigenous people that we don't get acknowledged for. And sexuality and reproductive health and justice are no different. So there's a whole bunch of other things that people don't really know that are Indigenous concepts, like law. So like the U.S. legal system was built on the Haudenosaunee Confederacy that they kind of acknowledge but now use against us. So that's interesting. Feminism is also, to me, is an Indigenous concept. I don't think that women having equality or having autonomy is a new concept by any means. Medicine and government, those are different things that as Indigenous people we started. And so we need to add on another bullet there to do with, if it's not sexual and reproductive health, it's our rights over our own bodies and spaces. And that's an easier way and a more accessible way for more people to look at this and adopt it as something that they might want to have in their own lives. Next slide, please. So What the heck do I mean by Aboriginal? I think a lot of people get confused with this word because it's a word that's used primarily in Canada and in Australia and New Zealand. So what I mean by that, by Aboriginal, the dictionary says that it means original or earliest, native or indigenous. In the Canadian legal system, it represents Indians, Métis, and Inuit. And so when I'm talking about our teachings and our cultures, I am hoping that people recognize the diversity that exists among us. There are over 750 First Nations between Canada and the United States alone. So there is a huge amount of diversity, and I am not putting everybody under the same umbrella and saying it's all the same for everybody. And to that effect, if you can hit the next slide, Simon. Currently in Canada, we have over 1 million Aboriginal people. So the 2006 Stats Canada Census said that we're over 1 million. But more importantly, that 50% or over 50% of our population is under the age of 25 right now. 50% across Canada. In places like Nunavut and Labrador even, 70 to 80% of the population is under 25. That's huge. That's a huge impressionable population right now. And the birth rate in our communities, it's interesting when I read all of the Public Health Agency of Canada reports on reproduction and the birth rate in Canada, all saying that teen pregnancy is low right now, not in Aboriginal communities, not even close. If 50% of our population is under the age of 25, what does that mean? That means that there's a young, very young, and younger population that's going on. And it's mirrored in the United States, right? So 69 out of 1,000 is the Native American pregnancy rate compared to 49 out of 1,000. That's a huge comparison to look at. And so we are dealing right now with a population that needs reproductive justice and needs to know that there are options and that they have support, and that all these numbers and sayings that we're doing so well in sexual and reproductive health and rights don't exactly necessarily apply for all populations, especially the one who started the concept. Next slide, please. So this isn't to take away from Jessica Shaw's presentation, because she will be showing you guys the access report in Canada. This is the map of accessible abortion services in Canadian hospitals that Canadians for Choice did in 2006 that Jessica coordinated. So she'll be talking to you guys about that. The only thing I wanted to mention here is where you see the red dots, and they're really small, is a little bit old. There's a couple of extra dots that are updated now. But that's where there are accessible abortion services in hospitals in Canada. And beyond the fact that many of us, particularly on the East Coast, know how difficult it is to access an abortion, I want you to look, and I want you to look especially above those red dots, especially in the north, and I want you to think about who lives there. Who lives there? Predominantly. It's not just us. There are Aboriginal people living in northern parts of Canada, especially in the Northwest Territories, in the Yukon, in Nunavut, in Nunavik, in Nunatsiavut, all the northern territories and subparts of Canada. And so when we talk about the fact that access to services sucks, what we're not talking about is who does access suck for, and I'm not, that kind of sounds funny, but you know what I'm saying? Who is access not so good for, and why? And what does it mean if you don't have access and you are an Aboriginal person living in those parts of Canada? What does that mean for you? What happens if you are an Aboriginal woman who's living in, let's say, Nunavut? Let's say you're living in Pang. And Pang is actually
just right here.
If you're living in Pang, Pang has like a 76.7% teen pregnancy rate in that community. And let's say you either wanted to parent, have your child in a hospital, there are no hospitals there, obviously, or if you wanted to terminate your pregnancy, what would you have to do? Catherine is saying you would have to fly south. Absolutely. Let's say you wanted to terminate your pregnancy. Okay? you get funding for that, hopefully. And if you do get funding for that, who are you going to have to tell? Your parents. Your parents may, you could keep it a secret from your parents, probably for like a few days, until, who would you have to tell? The nurse, right? A nurse or a doctor, if you have one, somebody in the community who's responsible for fly-in and fly-out medevac or medical transportation in that community. And anybody, is anybody here from a small community? So what happens when one person in the community knows that you're flying out and you were pregnant before you left? Everybody knows, right? Everybody knows. Of course everybody's going to know. Are you going to, is, are people here, are you comfortable putting your whole reproductive health agenda on someone's lap and saying, I need a flight to get an abortion, thanks? Not exactly. I would not feel comfortable, especially in a small community, saying, I need a flight to go south with all my justice and rights, and yeah, I probably wouldn't. I would not feel comfortable, particularly if that was my own family. And as many people know, our families are sometimes the hardest people to get on the same page with our own beliefs, right? So if that's the case, it is that much more difficult not just to access services, but to have confidentiality and also to be demonized in your own community. Because if the last people who were in your community were the ministers and the missionaries who told you that sexuality and having sex was wrong, if those were the last people that were up there, do you think that the knowledge of having a right to have an abortion is staying in this community? Not necessarily. And I'm not speaking for all communities. So that's the reality of what we're talking about in terms of who doesn't have services and why. If you can hit the next slide, please. And so if we kind of look at it from an urban versus rural or remote perspective of this young population that we have, there is a percentage difference in terms of more young people leaving rural places to come to cities. And that's something that we have to be aware of in the RJ movement, is this migration and transition of young people going back and forth. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is a little pop quiz time. How many people here know what Canada means? What does the word Canada mean? Anybody? So it's often translated to small village. Anybody heard that? Or welcoming, or the meeting place, or something nice like that. Can you hit enter, Simon? So the word is Kanata, and if you could hit enter, it is a Wendat Huron word for settlement. That's the actual translation of it. Why is it always usually translated as village or meeting place or something else? What's the difference between a village and a settlement? What'd you say, Holly? A village could be more permanent. Does a settlement imply somebody lives there already? And you settled there? Yeah, that's what a settlement means. It means that people were living there before, and then you settled. And it's often translated to village because it sounds more permanent, like you're staying. And also, it just sounds nicer than saying, oh yeah, we settled on Canada. Who wants to say that? It doesn't sound so nice. And I think this is a really important thing to remember when we're trying to talk about reproductive justice today, is this is a whole bunch of things that people don't want to acknowledge. And it's no wonder that reproductive justice is one of them, and the sort of intersections that we want to have. We're coming from a 500 plus year legacy of not wanting to come to terms with reality. And if that's true back then, it's absolutely true today. You can hit the next slide, Simon. So historically, people have heard of these different things that Canada doesn't want to come to terms with in terms of where RJ knowledge was erased. And so you can look very plainly at that from the Indian Act, so things like matrimonial real property, which still exists today. So if you are a status First Nation woman and you are married to a man who owns a house, if that man passes away, divorces you, leaves you or something, you no longer have possession or right over that property. That is still something that exists in the Indian Act. It's called matrimonial real property. That, and there was also things like Bill C-31 that many of us have heard of, and that's how I got my status back 3 years ago, was if a Native woman married outside the community, she lost her status as being a registered Indian. Everybody here has heard of residential mission industrial boarding schools? Yes? So one of the things I often think that people don't look at residential school from an RJ lens is that not only was it supposed to beat the Indian out of the child, it deemed Aboriginal women unfit for child rearing, unfit for motherhood, unfit for having what would be the same type of knowledge or knowledge base that the Western white world would have. And it also taught children a patriarchal distribution of workload and who was in charge. And so if you can see, why would the government specifically disempower Aboriginal women? If we're coming from this huge knowledge of being the center of communities, of having rights over our own bodies, of deciding when we wanted to have children, if you want to colonize a people, you're going to take away the center. That's really easy to see. Next slide, please. So we've also, throughout the years, seen sterilization, removal of children, and so like some 70% of children in state care right now are First Nations, and patriarchal institutions of leadership, where we have things like band and chief council, 90% of which are men. And we've lost some of our women's councils, our societies, and those groups that used to help women make those decisions over their bodies, their spaces, and their families. One of the other teachings that is kind of spread across Indigenous societies is this concept of non-interference, which means trusting women, trusting men to make the best decisions for themselves and their families, so not interfering. And people have taken that to mean interfere. But if the root was non-interference and was community support for whatever decision needed to be made. And that was true of two-spirited people as well. As a two-spirited person, it ain't a new thing, because if back in the day the work needed to be done, then shit got done. And it wasn't like, you can't do that because you can't. No, it needed to get done. Of course it needed to get done. Next slide, please, Simon. Today we also, so coming from those roots, we are looking today at the clinicization of healthcare and how the services that we do have in hospitals and clinics and those types of medicalized spaces don't respect or integrate traditional knowledge. And a lot of times when I've tried to access emergency contraception, and I've done it many, many times, a lot of people are like, in my community are like, well, that's just a sellout for your own body. And I'm like, well, the knowledge in which I would have known how to prevent a pregnancy was beaten out of my head. So I don't have that knowledge anymore. I'm going to rely on the pharmacy. And for me, it's very simplistic like that. I know I have the right to that knowledge, and I know I should know ancestrally that knowledge in my community, but I don't know it anymore. And so I will go the route of the clinicized form of healthcare, but I want to look at the best of both worlds. I want to know that in this modern white world that we're living in today, that there's going to be some acknowledgement of the roots that I come from, but there's also going to be my right to access what I would have known had it not been beaten out of my head and out of my own community. Next slide, please, Simon. Okay, so you can kind of sum up all those things as social exclusion. So what I just kind of presented to everybody were gendered racism, systemic discrimination, and lateral violence within the community of people not wanting to believe that women have rights over their own bodies and spaces. Today we see it perpetuated by things like colonization, patriarchy, Christianization, and capitalism. And if you kind of look at that in a circle, it does affect one another, which is why RJ is such an important framework to decolonize from that and deconstruct it. And I'm going to show you exactly what I mean by that. So we know that colonization is still happening today. Anybody think it's not happening anymore? Awesome. Next slide. James Baldwin did a really good job of summing up Why We Need RJ in 1920. And I want to read it out because it's a really important quote for me that helps me use RJ today. So he said that the American ideal of sexuality appears to be rooted in the American ideal of masculinity. This idea has created cowboys and Indians, good guys and bad guys, punks and studs, tough guys and softies, butch and faggot, black and white. It is an ideal so paralytically infantile that it is virtually forbidden as an unpatriotic act that the American boy evolve into the complexity of manhood. And he said that in 1921. And he, James Baldwin, if you don't know who he is, he's a queer black American writer. And to my knowledge, from what Gudgie Cook has told me, is that he did come to Agwesasne, where I'm from, once in his life, and that he was writing alongside some of the midwives that were there who shared with him this binary system that colonization has created in sexual and reproductive health, where we only have choices to do one or the other, as opposed to having like a fluidity or a spectrum of what we know would be better healthcare services for all of us. And that's something that we fight for in funding to get projects done. That's something that we fight for with our friends and our family to get them to understand. But it is this binary thing that the West has imposed that makes us fight each other. And now we fight for funding, like I said, we fight for activism, we fight to be right, we fight. And for me, that means we need to deconstruct and decolonize if we're ever gonna get to RJ in our own lives. Next slide, please. Okay, so what does decolonization mean? This is a teaching from my community. So if it's undoing colonization, it means three things. It means having land and expanding that definition of land or space. It means having language, and I don't just mean the language that you're speaking, I mean the communication. And it also means having people, whether that's physical bodies, whether that's a whole community, whether that's countries. It is those three things that we need in order to decolonize and undo what's been done. So I'll give you an example of that. Can you hit the next slide, Simon? If you look at the lens of cultural competency and sex work, okay? So we know that if we're going to apply an RJ framework to sex work and culture, it means three things. So knowing where we're at, knowing where some people don't want us to go, and knowing what our past is and the option to include it in our future, which means that I know that sexuality is a human instinct and is a natural human ability. But if I'm a sex worker today, and I have been on and off a sex worker throughout my whole life, if I want to incorporate my culture with it, I need to know where I'm at with that. I need to know where the people in my own community are going to say sex work is wrong. And I also need to know that I might have had a past where women were able to trade sex and have multiple partners and nobody cared about that. But I might not want to include it in my future today. I might not want to identify as Aboriginal when I'm sex working for a variety of reasons. So that's an example of the decolonization process in terms of land, language, and people, and where it applies to RJ in terms of culture and sex work. So that's just to give you an example of those types of ways that we try to apply it. And I'm speaking very broadly because I'm trying to encompass many different populations and peoples. Next slide, please, Simon. So in terms of like what does that mean for service delivery? If I were to apply an RJ framework to sex work in our organization, which we do, there are things like violence prevention we need to incorporate, sexual assault, historical context. We need to intersect harm reduction with culture, but we also need to look at reclaiming, restructuring, and reasserting a matriarchal theory, which means that not only women being empowered to do what they want with their own bodies, but a matriarchal system of deciding who's in charge of that and who gets to be in charge of the way that sex is treated, the way that people want to engage with it or not engage with it, etc. Next slide, please, Simon. So to finish off here, we know that if we're going to talk about all of this stuff and the way we want to get information and educate ourselves, both about RJ, both about sexuality. It has, you need the skills and the resources to do stuff, but it's a lot more about the attitudes. It's a lot more about how we approach things, how we look at them, what we're willing to acknowledge and what we're not willing to acknowledge, or what we don't want to talk about, as uncomfortable or as long as it takes, right? And people often, I remember, I've been fighting on the front lines in South Dakota over the last 2 years, every time abortion was close to being illegal. And this past year, I remember when the whole Proposition 8 thing was happening in California. Is everybody familiar with Proposition 8? So they were trying to illegalize gay marriage. And I was in South Dakota at the same time, because it was, you vote for laws in a lot of states during the same time as the election was happening. And I remember being in South Dakota, and we were leading a Native American emergency task force. And I remember hearing on the radio, listening to Proposition 8, people saying in California, and everybody, I think, I'm sure a lot of you remember this, the reason that they lost the gay marriage vote was because of Black people and communities of color, and that it was their fault that they voted against it, and because their societies are backwards and what have you. And of course it turned out that the older white population were actually the ones who voted more percentagely against it. But irrelevant of that, I was sitting there and I was thinking, who the hell told us that it was wrong? Where did we get that information from? Why is it so controversial in our communities? Where did that start? Do people not think that colonialism happened not just in Native communities, but across all communities of color that have indigenous roots? And very often in my work today, by my own community, I'm told that it's not traditional what I'm doing. It's not traditional what you're doing, Jessica. Stop it. You shouldn't be talking about sex. It's wrong. To which I say, and this is something that I've had to tell my grandparents repeatedly, because they're always like, why are you talking about SEX, Jessica, all the time? They can't even say sex. I have to say to them, and I have to remember that they both went to residential school. And they had no chance, no opportunity to learn this information and this knowledge. So when they're telling me it ain't traditional, I have to think, when did it stop becoming traditional? According to whose tradition? Before, my traditional is pre-1492, pre-Christopher Columbus. They're traditional because they're old. They've been told that they know everything. And they never got the chance to learn. And so back to me being in South Dakota, that was so similar, because I was sitting there thinking, you know what? This whole thing of this stuff not being our fault now, and it is it is the most controversial in our communities. We really need to deconstruct that kind of stuff. We really need to understand where that's coming from if you really want to work against it, or if you really want to open up more spaces for people. Because so long as, you know, me being in South Dakota and the anti-choicers making signs that say, who are not Native, saying abortion is wrong in your culture and translating it into indigenous languages is like the most offensive thing for me to watch, both on a present day level of knowing that ain't true and historically. And it's like being recolonized again and again and again, the more we think that this has nothing to do with us or that this isn't part of our culture. It is part of our culture. Next slide, please. So my recipe for empowerment looks like three things. So one being, if you could hit enter, Simon, consent. One being, you'd hit enter again, having choice, and the other one being pleasure. And I don't mean like feathers, handcuffs, pleasure only, but if that's your bag, that's awesome. I mean expanding the English word of what pleasure means. For some people, having a night without rape is pleasurable. Having the ability to know what feels good and what doesn't feel good is pleasurable. So we need to get, again, outside these binaries that make us fight against each other and what we want to define. So Simon, I'm going to ask you to hit enter one more time. Self-determination and sovereignty over bodies and spaces is what it's about. And so to close, I'm going to do a little pop quiz for some prizes that I have up here. So to see if everybody was listening or not listening, because we're in a university, right? Says the person who left university after a year. We're going to do a little myth or fact, okay? So you can ask your neighbor for help with this, but we're going to, Jane, you can help me. The first person to put their hand up, don't yell it out, wins. Now you can't just say if this was a myth or is it a fact. You have to tell me why. Why is it a myth? Why is it a fact? Okay? Ready, Simon? Hit enter. So is this a myth or a fact? Aboriginal or Indigenous people started the idea of sex education. Hands up, no yelling, hands up first. Holly, why is it a fact? Did everybody hear that? Do you want me to say it? Okay. So Aboriginal women, it was necessary for Aboriginal women to know their own bodies and spaces if they were the foundation of the community. Do we accept that as an answer? I think yes. I think great, Holly. So come up after and I'll give you your prize. So next myth or fact. Birth control methods only started with the wave of the feminist movement in the 1960s. Well, hold, you have to raise your hand. But I think she had it first, hey?
Yeah. That's myth.
That's a myth? Why? And there are teachings in our community. So in my community, there's a teaching that you only have as many children as you can grab at a time. So how many children can you grab at a time? Maybe two, right? And this is not like universal law. This is like a suggestion. So how would you space out your kids then? What were some traditional ways you could have spaced out your kids? Breastfeeding? What else? Right, traditional herbs, medicines, and that people romanticize that history today. There are whole like companies, you know, capitalizing off of like, ooh, look at this like new wave method of like fertility awareness. And I'm like, for real? Like, that's been going on for thousands of years, man. I should get some of those profits. Just kidding. So did she get that answer? I think yes. Thank you. Next one. It was traditional to receive education about your body from the family and community around me, like my grandmother or auntie. Myth or fact?
I think it's a fact. You talked a lot about these traditional ideas of community and women's councils teaching each other how to deal with situations like pregnancy or about bodies and how you get pregnant and sex and stuff.
Right. Absolutely. And we tokenize our elders today, and I'm sure Catherine can attest to this a lot, by only asking them to open and close stuff, rather than asking them to be an integral part of what it is we're trying to do, right? If it is just about young people want to learn from elders, and elders can learn from young people, and vice versa. So if you really want to do a cross-generational or intergenerational work, you would know that, you know, a lot of us are like, ooh, I would never want to learn about sex from my grandmother. That's just gross. But there's a reason that Talk Sex with Sue was like a huge hit. She's old. Obviously, she's lived through it and had a lot of sex. Regardless of her perspectives on things, that makes sense. And it is something that not only was it important for families, it's interesting today because today, sex education is out of the community and out of the home. That is probably the hardest place to talk about it for, and a lot of us who work in this field know that. It is so hard for parents and guardians and community members to come to terms with this. And it's not to say that sex education shouldn't be in schools, because I am absolutely for comprehensive sex ed in school. What I don't like is the institutionalization of having no community autonomy over those knowledge and no incorporation of whatever the family unit means to you, or if home is on the street or in a mansion, if it's going to be full circle, it's got to be from that perspective. At least that's what it means to me. So does she? I think you get that. Yes, I think so. And this is the last one. This is a trick question. Trick question, okay? Go ahead, Simon. Decisions over land, resources, and family were often the business of women. Trick question. Who wants to be brave? Come on. Balance. Right. So can you get it enter, Simon? It's facts. Well, sometimes 50%, it's that. And also, what did I say at the beginning about the diversity of Aboriginal people? I'm not talking for all of us. I'm talking from my own perspective. But I refuse to believe that women were just disrespected ninnies. They were, no matter what community you're from, they're human and humans are respected, right? That's how we kind of got screwed in the first place, right? So... nobody thinks that's funny? I think that's funny. So I think you do get that answer too. Very, well done. Well done. All right. So I'm going to ask Simon to hit enter two more times. A resource that I want to leave you guys with is something we helped develop with the Canadian Council on Learning. It's the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Holistic Life Learning Model of Sexuality, Reproductive Health, and Justice. So it's on the Canadian Council of Learning's website, which is ccl-cca.ca, or you can go to our website. If you could hit enter, Simon, you could also check out our book that was mentioned. And I want to leave you with one of my favorite quotes that I added on to, if you could hit enter. A lot of people have heard, only until the heart of its women are on the ground, only then will we be conquered. But I think we need to add on, and we ain't about to go out like that. So, Miawe, thank you. You can just keep hitting enter, Simon. This is my contact info. Our posters and information are up here. And I would ask that our prize winners come up and come and collect your prizes. If you could enter one more time. There we go. One more time. And that's our website. And our posters are up here for people to take information. So, Nyangoa, thank you all for listening. Are we doing QA or no? Later. Great, thank you. And Catherine Martin is here, as was mentioned earlier. So welcome, Catherine.